gonna stop.
Mr. Speaker, sir, it is my first and pleasant duty to join the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, in congratulating my honourable friends, the members for Davie Hume and for Sherwood, on the most excellent, witty and stylistic way in which they proposed the loyal address and the great eloquence and research which they both brought to their task. My honourable friend, the maiden before Davie Hume, knows well the problems of bringing the older industrial areas into new modern technological industries. He was instrumental in trying to get an urban development corporation for Trafford Park, some of which falls in his constituency, because he wants to bring to that area. Very well, some of which falls very close to his constituency, and that might matter too, because he wants to bring to that area some of the very good works that have already been apparent in the urban development corporations in Docklands and on Merseyside. He has also dealt with Britain's role in the world and the need for strong defence and the need to be a reliable ally in NATO, which is absolutely vital to our defence policy. Less well known, perhaps, is his work for health in the community, because he is... Mr. Speaker, I would like to get on a little bit.
I don't think the Prime Minister is giving way. Prime Minister.
May I at least finish congratulating my honourable friends and get on to some political content, obviously. Less well known is my honourable friend's work for health in the community. He happens to be a pilot and has voluntarily, frequently at very short notice, put himself on duty to fetch pharmaceuticals urgently needed for a hospital and to fetch organs for spare part surgery. We thank him for that work, which is much less well known than it should be. My honourable friend follows his family's great tradition in serving this House, but we pay tribute to his work today for all that he has done for us on his own account. I also congratulate my honourable friend, the member for Sherwood, on his excellent and witty speech and for his tremendous victory 2 weeks ago. We remember the firm stand he took against intimidation and the right to go to work during the coal strike won him the support... Right to go to work during the coal strike won him the support of local miners and the support of the overwhelming majority of people up and down this country. Mr. Speaker, I note that...
Order! It's very unseemly to have a shouted order! Order! Well, if the honourable gentleman remains silent, he may have his chance later on to say it at greater length, but not from a sedentary position.
Mr. Speaker, I listened very carefully to what the Right Honourable Gentleman said during his speech. He seemed very long on words, he seemed very short on content, and I began to understand why he lost the general election in such a decisive way. He also seemed to address so many of his remarks to some of the shibboleths of the 30s. Those have absolutely no appeal whatsoever to the population of our country, which is becoming home-owning, share-owning and savings-owning and having an independence. They would never have thought. Those class shibboleths have no relevance at all to our modern society. People know full well they have a higher standard of living than they've ever had before, that comes from cooperation between a government which, together with partnership of the people, has brought about economic strength and standards of healthcare and social security we have never had before. Repeat, never had before. Before I give way to the honourable gentleman, I'm on the political part of the speech.
Honourable lady, explain why house prices are falling dramatically in Merseyside and rising. Especially in Sefton, the lowest rated metropolitan district in the country, with a 20-year record of Conservative control. Has it got anything to do with unemployment?
Mr. Speaker, I hope that one day Merseyside will welcome the private sector to within Liverpool and therefore confound what Mr. Kilroy Silk said in a very perceptive way. When he said, in fact, the militants and their ilk in Liverpool are the biggest deterrents to job creation on Merseyside that there have ever been. Mr. Speaker, the
Eric Heffarp.
The Right Honourable Lady will, the Right Honourable Lady will know that at lunchtime today, I happened to meet her at a certain reception and asked her, would she actually come to Liverpool and see for herself what has been done by the local authority in that area, the houses that have been built, the sports centres that have been built, and the work that's necessary, and would she then perhaps change her mind in relation to what local authorities under Labour control have been doing for the people of areas like Liverpool?
Mr. Speaker, I wasn't aware that we were able to refer to such matters in this debate, but as the Honourable Gentleman is aware, I shall be going round, of course, to see a number of inner cities. But what I was referring to was what Mr. Kilroy Silk said had brought Liverpool low. Yes, had brought Liverpool low, and he gives me the chance to finish the quotation. Dozens of times, he said, in the last few years, I've tried fruitlessly to persuade companies that I knew were looking for sites for new plants to locate on Merseyside and in Knowsley. And each time the decision went against us because of their perception of our militancy. If we want more jobs on Merseyside, Labour local authorities will have to welcome private enterprise to within their borders. Now, Mr. Speaker, at the heart of the gracious speech is the section which refers to the economy, and at the heart of Britain's economic strength are the continuing policies of sound financial management. They're designed to reduce inflation further, they're designed to keep firm control of public expenditure, and to increase enterprise and employment by incentives and training. It takes time to establish a reputation for prudent economic policies of the kind which Germany and Switzerland enjoy, with all the benefits that it brings. But Britain is now succeeding. Control of inflation through sound financial policies is and will remain our top priority. It has been the habit in the last two terms and in the next term the same for government to set the financial and legal framework. But the wealth of a country is the effort of its people and the way they respond to that framework. And they have responded, and that is what's brought a very high standard of living. But effort depends upon incentives. And these truths are frequently forgotten by those who make easy election promises. But as the result of the last election showed, people were not taken in by those in any way. And the fundamental wisdom of the truths that I've enunciated was acknowledged then. One moment. Those policies have brought record living standards and better standards of health and social services than ever before. And the news since the dissolution has confirmed the sense and soundness of our policies. No, not while I'm on this particular section. I'm talking about the news since the dissolution. It is good news, so of course honourable members opposite won't want to hear it. Good balance of payments figures. Inflation at 4%, still too high, but far less than the 7% Labour say they would be happy to start with. Continuing growth in industrial production and in national income. Encouraging business surveys from the CBI and the Chambers of Commerce. Lower mortgage rates and lower gas prices. Record British Telecom profits helping to finance a record £2 billion investment programme. And the OECD forecasts that Britain this year will have the fastest growth of all the major industrial countries. That is all of the good news since this election, save one thing which I have my held back. Yes, I will give way to the honourable gentleman who comes from Scotland, which has the second highest income per head of any part of the United Kingdom after London and the South East. I give way.
Dennis Canavan!
The Prime Minister mentioned a couple of minutes ago there her general election success, but her party in Scotland has been reduced to such a discredited rump that the Scottish Tory MPs couldn't even form a football team. And the Secretary of State for Scotland is like some discredited colonial governor-general who received no democratic mandate from the people he governs. Why is there no mention of that in the Queen's speech? Why in particular is there no mention of proposals to do what the majority of people of Scotland want, namely the setting up of a devolved Scottish Parliament with legislative and economic powers to help repair a lot of the damage that's been done by 8 hard years of Thatcherism?
I seem to remember the honourable gentleman made a similar interruption in 1983. I seem to remember that I gave him a similar reply to the reply that I'm going to give now. In 3 out of the last 5 Labour governments, Conservatives had more seats in England than Labour. And we had to endure it. What is he proposing? Separatism? Separatism? May I point out what the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, said on a devolution bill in this House in 1977? At this point, the now Leader of the Opposition said, I could pause for cheers from the SNP and Plaid Cymru. They know and they must acknowledge that their preposterous ideas of economic self-dependence in any degree of economic separation and the consequences that go with it would mean utter misery for the people of both Scotland and Wales. Now, may I say to the honourable gentleman, I have left the best good news until last. But before I come to that, I would say that we must, of course, be alert, in spite of our good news, to the risks to the international economy discussed at the Venice summit, the agreements reached there on the need for surplus and deficit countries to take action to correct their imbalances will need to be translated into action. But the best news is a continuing fall in unemployment, confirmed by last month's figures, the largest monthly fall ever. Other than in Northern Ireland, unemployment has fallen in the last year throughout the country, fastest in Wales, the North West, the West Midlands, and the North. Sustained economic growth is now creating enough jobs to reduce the number of people unemployed, even though the population of working age is increasing. Nevertheless, no, I'm going to carry on a little longer, otherwise I shall be speaking for too long and I don't wish to do that. Nevertheless, I'm on the particular point that sustained economic growth is now creating enough jobs to reduce the number of people unemployed, even though the population of working age is increasing. I give way on that particular point.
I'm very interested and, of course, very pleased when there is any real reduction in unemployment. Would the Prime Minister be able to tell the House when the unemployment figure will be down to the figure it was on May the 3rd, 1979?
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman is aware, when we came into power in 1979, the hidden unemployment, the restrictive practices, The failure of the then Labour government to deal with things left us a problem. Perhaps he will read the passage in Mr. Donoghue's book about it. Labour's problem was that its general commitments to industrial investment and maintaining full employment, as well as its close ties with the trade unions, made it politically difficult to cut out the bad parts of British industry, even though it was essential for its long-term efficiency and survival. And unless we had done that, there would be far more unemployment than there is now, and British industry is now efficient and doing very well. It's a very interesting book. I will perhaps have time to quote rather more from it during what I have to say to this. Nevertheless, government special schemes will continue to play a very important part.
Order.
There will be guaranteed places.
Order. Order. The order. Leader of the opposition had a fair hearing. So should the Prime Minister.
Oh, what?
Order. Prime Minister.
Nevertheless, government special schemes will continue to play a very important part, and there'll be guaranteed places on the youth training scheme, an excellent scheme for school leavers under 18 who do not go into employment or further education. Yes, legislation will be introduced to enable benefit to be withheld from those young people who deliberately choose to remain unemployed, and quite rightly so. Moreover, Mr. Speaker, we believe that job centres should be transferred from the Manpower Services Commission to the Department of Employment so that they can work more closely with unemployment benefit offices to provide a more effective service of help. And we shall consult the Manpower Services Commission accordingly. Job opportunities are growing steadily. 1,100,000 more since March 1983. And our task is to help ensure that those seeking work have the right training to fill them and the help to start a business on their own, if they so wish. Mr. Speaker, I refer now to something I referred to in replying to the Right Honourable Gentleman. The spreading ownership of housing, shares, pensions and savings has been one of the great achievements of the past 8 years. And it is one reason, this bringing independence and power to the people, that the Right Honourable Gentleman's party did so badly in that election. They do not want the songs and policies of collectivism. They want the capacity and the ability and the opportunity to own their own house, shares, pensions and many, many other things besides. Labour favours what they now call social ownership, that is nationalisation in sheep's clothing. The effect would be to concentrate power in Whitehall and to deprive millions of ordinary people of their shareholding in industry. By contrast, we will continue our programme of privatisation, freeing businesses to respond to the needs of the customer and increasing the opportunities for share ownership. Now we have a new task. Just as we took power from trades union bosses and restored it to their members, so we must now extend to the people new freedoms and responsibilities in housing, education and local authority finance. These will be the subject of three major bills signalled in the gracious speech. It is our purpose to bring new opportunities into the inner cities in particular and to make town halls more accountable. For nowhere are the damaging effects of dependence and socialism seen more clearly than in some of our inner cities. First, Mr. Speaker, we shall abolish the domestic rates, a grossly unfair tax, and replace them with a community charge. Subject to proper protection for those in need, it is right that we should all pay something towards the cost of local services from which we all benefit. And the new unified business rate will protect businesses and jobs in inner cities from the councils which obstruct wealth and job creation by imposing very high rates. As the House knows, in spite of these high rates, some local authorities, Labour local authorities, have plunged recklessly into debt. And I take this opportunity to make clear once again that the government has never stood behind the debts of local authorities and will not do so now. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, we have made great strides towards a property-owning democracy. 1 million council houses have been sold since 1979, and two-thirds of our people...
Order! Both honourable gentlemen, if the Prime Minister doesn't give way, they must not persist.
Mr. Speaker, we have made great strides towards a property-owning democracy. 1 million council houses have been sold since 1979, and two-thirds of our people now own their own homes. We will ensure that home ownership continues to spread by maintaining mortgage tax relief and the tenant's right to buy. Mr. Speaker, if one wishes to contrast the Labour government's attitude towards housing and how they resisted any attempt to bring increasing freedom to people to purchase their houses or increasing freedom in other ways, one has only to look at Mr. Donoghue's account of the Labour years in power. He says this on page 104 of his book: Labour's housing policy was dominated by dogma and the vested interests of a minority of activists whose power was based on the local authority building departments and who were out of touch with and apparently completely unconcerned with the wishes of British families. Mr. Speaker, our new task, no, I'm going on, I've given away a very great deal, I must go on. Our new task must be to extend the benefits of greater choice and independence to those in rented accommodation. Rent controls have reduced the private sector to a mere 8% of the housing market, with the result that there is almost a municipal monopoly in rented housing. And too many tenants are confined to large, monolithic and sometimes badly kept council estates. And it's high time for town hall monopoly to be replaced by individual choice in renting. We shall therefore introduce major housing reforms in this session. First, we shall give council tenants, where they are dissatisfied with their landlords, the right to transfer to other approved landlords, such as tenant cooperatives and housing associations. Second, urban development corporations have been successful in restoring derelict industrial areas, and we believe that a similar approach could be adopted for housing in some places. We'll therefore take powers to create housing action trusts, initially on a pilot basis, to take over and renovate areas of council housing in especially bad repair. But wider choice in housing also requires a revival of the private rented sector. For new lettings, I repeat, for new lettings, we will therefore bring forward a series of proposals to reduce rent controls, for they have so greatly restricted the supply of homes for rent. 500,000 private sector properties now lie empty, and our proposals will help to bring those back onto the market. In all these measures, existing tenants will keep their present protection in respect of rents and security of tenure, and we will strengthen the law against harassment. All of these policies have been set out in a manifesto, the most detailed manifesto ever set before the British people, a manifesto which said what we were going to do, not like those opposite, which tried to conceal what they were doing. No wonder when you hear them today. A home should be a source of pride to the family living in it, regardless of whether it is owned or rented. Greater choice and independence will help to make it so. I contrast once again our whole policy on housing, which has brought more ownership, more opportunity and choice to people, with the policy of the party opposite. And what again Mr. Donoghue said, the left wing of the Labour Party began to mobilise hostility to what they saw as a threat to their local authority power bases. Although they themselves personally often enjoyed the pleasure and benefits of living in their own private Hampstead homes, they were dogmatically committed to denying those pleasures and benefits to council tenants. We have given them to those tenants and shall continue to do so. No, I'm going on to the reform of education. The reform of education is the third of the fundamental reforms to be introduced this session. Although in many of our local authorities children are receiving an excellent education, in others there is widespread dissatisfaction. In too many schools, education doesn't match either what the parents want or what the children need. And in this first session of the new Parliament, we shall bring forward a major bill which will introduce a national curriculum with clear attainment targets and tests during the period of compulsory schooling, which will prevent local education authorities from putting artificial limits on numbers, so making it possible for popular schools to take in more pupils. A bill which will enable maintained schools to opt out of local authority control where parents and governing bodies so wish, and to be funded directly from the Department of Education and Science. And the Right Honourable Gentleman knew that when he made his mischievous statement at that dispatch box. He knows that no fees will be payable to those schools, for those pupils of those schools who opt out. A bill which will allow London boroughs to pull out of the Inner London Education Authority and run their own education service. And the bill, one moment, when I finish this particular piece on this particular bill, and which will give many head teachers and governing bodies within local authorities control over the budgets of their schools, and where some of the local authorities have started this, they have met with great success and far better use of money. I give way to the Right Honourable Gentleman.
Neil Kinnock.
Is she saying, when she says no fees, that there will be no requirement that can be enforced by an LEA or any school in the maintained sector that makes the provision of music, of field trips that are essential for the curriculum, of art, of sport, or any other subject on the recognised curriculum dependent upon a parental contribution or the payment of any fee?
On the same financial basis as local education authority schools. Their fees, their finances. I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker. There will be no fees. There will be no fees.
Order! 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 The Prime Minister.
Will be on the same financial basis as schools under local education authorities. Their finances will not come from the local education authority. Their finances.
Order!
Their finances will come from the Department of Education and Science. There will be no fees payable by the parents. What the Right Honourable Gentleman is referring to at the moment, there will be no fees payable by the parents. What the Right Honourable Gentleman is referring to is cases that have come up from the Ombudsman and before the courts as to whether charges and schools in local education authorities are permissible for things like for extras such as holidays overseas and music. That is a case under local education authorities which is now being dealt with. The schools which opt out will be on a similar basis to those of local education authorities, but their finances will not come from the local education authority. It will come from the Department of Education and Science. It's no good the Honourable Gentleman mouthing fees. There will be no fees payable by parents.
Kinnock.
I'm grateful. Can the Prime Minister then tell us, will she ensure that the legislation required to permit schools to opt out will prohibit the charging of fees as a condition of entry? First, I'm asking the Prime Minister. Secondly, can I ask her whether what she describes as extras can be made subject to charges? I'm familiar with the Hereford and other cases which the courts have held that it's illegal to charge for those subjects recognised to be part of the curriculum. Is she proposing that law be changed in order that schools can charge fees for what she very loosely describes as extras?
Mr. Speaker, those cases are now have gone through the Ombudsman and are now going through the courts. My Right Honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Education, issued a statement, I believe, about that yesterday and is taking consultation upon the results of those cases. The Right Honourable Gentleman will have masses of opportunity when this bill comes before the House. It will be a very considerable bill. Mr. Speaker, parents want schools to provide their children with the knowledge, the training and character.
Order! Order! Lest the Prime Minister gives way, the Honourable Gentleman and Right Honourable Gentlemen must resume their seat.
Give way, the right. Mr. Speaker, parents want schools which will provide.
I'll hear it.
That's grateful, sir.
the first point of order of the new Parliament, and a very good one, and a genuine one. Will you ensure, sir, that tomorrow, when Hansard is scrutinised, it contains an exact report of what the Prime Minister has actually said this afternoon?
Order. Hansard always does that.
Captain Willen, I shall be very grateful because it makes it clear that no fees will be payable for these schools. Mr. Speaker, may I just finish this paragraph and I'll give way to the right honourable gentleman. Parents want schools which will provide their children with the knowledge, training and character to fit them for today's world. They want them to be taught basic educational skills. We shall enlarge the right of parents to choose those schools which will best meet the needs of their children. And this legislation sets out to achieve the most far-reaching reform of education since the 1944 Education Act. I give way to the right honourable gentleman.
Would the Prime Minister let the Prime Minister say what are the selection procedures for these schools? Will they follow the same non-selective procedures that are applied by the local authority? Or will the headmaster and the staff of the school be able to choose? That is the crucial question as to whether we are going to return to selective education.
Mr. Speaker, when a school opts out, it will opt out in the same character that it has inside the local education authority system. When schools are particularly popular, as a number are now, they also have to choose. They do not choose on the basis of an 11+, but they have their own very well-known methods of choice in practice. And the voluntary maintained schools, as he knows, are able to make their own choices. So it will not, in fact, be different. If the particular school wishes to change its character, then would have to make a fresh application to the Secretary of State for Education to do so. Mr. Speaker, may I carry on now with my own speech? Mr. Speaker, people's right to choice and independence must be safeguarded in other directions too. Since 1979, we have transformed industrial relations by strengthening the rights of trade union members. Yeah. And in the coming session, we shall take this a stage further, by ensuring that all members of trade union governing bodies are elected by secret postal ballot at least once every 5 years, by limiting further the abuse of the closed shop, by protecting individual members if they refuse to join a strike they disagree with, and by establishing a new trade union commissioner with the power to help individual trade union members to enforce their fundamental rights. Yeah. I believe these steps, like those before them, will be widely welcomed by members of trade unions throughout the country. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech, in fact, identifies some 17 of the bills which will be brought before Parliament in the present session. And overall, the government's legislative programme is one of the most substantial and radical in recent years. But I will not deal with all of these matters.
Order.
I wish to say a few words now on defence. Mr. Speaker, the gracious speech sets out the government's determination to keep Britain's defences strong and to work for reductions in the overall numbers of nuclear weapons. We shall update our independent nuclear deterrent with Trident and ensure that our forces are equipped with the most modern conventional weapons. Britain has taken a lead in shaping the West's position in the negotiations on intermediate and short...
Order. I suspect it's to ask why the Prime Minister didn't give way. I can't help the honourable gentleman.
Idea as a Scottish member whether any of the bills and things that the honourable, right honourable lady has been talking about are going to cover Scotland, because she has so far, Mr. Speaker, except in reference to my honourable friend, she has made no reference to any legislation for Scotland whatsoever, because she knows that she can introduce no legislation in Scotland because she hasn't got...
Order! 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 If the honourable gentleman and the House will give the Prime Minister an opportunity, she, no doubt, will deal with matters of that kind. Mr. David Ellis Thomas.
This issue that I was trying to ascertain from the Prime Minister on my intervention, whether in fact the education legislation will apply to Scotland and to Wales.
Order. Order. The Prime Minister deals with matters like that.
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman is aware, education in Scotland is rather different from education in England, and there is reference in the gracious speech, to a particular bill to deal with education in Scotland, as the Honourable Gentleman is aware. If the Honourable Gentleman is saying that because there are more Labour members in Scotland than Conservative, we cannot, in fact, legislate there, then I must point out to him many past Labour governments had no right to legislate whatsoever for England, and there will much of the legislation be absolutely not legal. That is absurd. We are the United Kingdom, and I hope we shall stay the United Kingdom.
Order! Order! I think it would be for the order. I think it would be for the convenience of the House if Prime Minister now got on with her speech. Then that leaves plenty of time for Right Honourable and Honourable members who are on the back benches to make their own contributions and to ask their own questions, which will be answered later in the debate.
Mr. Speaker, there must be many constituencies in Scotland who are very glad that Labour's policy on defence is not being carried through.
Yeah.
As I am on defence, Britain has taken a lead in shaping the West's position in the negotiations on intermediate and shorter range
order.
Missiles in Europe. And it is my belief that an
order. Order. The Prime Minister.
Consistent with NATO's security can be reached by the end of this year. The benches opposite have not learned the simple lesson that a strong defence policy and a successful arms control policy are directly linked. I realise the Honourable Gentleman wishes me to carry on speaking longer, and I'm very flattered, but I would like to keep my speech as short as possible. I recall the words of the former Prime Minister, Sir James Callaghan, speaking in this House last March on the deployment of...
Order!
Order!
Order! The Prime Minister... Order! The Honourable Gentleman... The Prime Minister is not giving way, and the Honourable Gentleman must resume his seat.
I'm recalling the words... Speaking in this House last March when he said, I have no doubt that our express determination to go ahead with the deployment of Cruz and Pershing brought Mr. Gorbachev back to the negotiating table. That is a lesson, he said, for people to learn now. But the voice of Sir James and those of many others going back to Hugh Gaitskill are no longer heard in today's Labour Party. The unilateralists and the surrender squads have taken over. And the views which were once held only by extremists are now the official policy of the opposition. But the British people have rejected the opposition's defence policy totally.
Yeah.
And today, at the beginning of our third term, Britain's voice is heard with respect in Europe, in the Soviet Union, and in the United States, because we have made Britain strong again, and because we have put freedom first. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, trust in the people. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I'm very nearly at the end, and I will not give way any further. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, trust in the people is at the very heart of our policies. And that is how we have, in the last 8 years, transformed the climate for business, brought over mighty trade unions within the rule of law, and created a new confidence at home and abroad. And that is why we were returned with such an excellent majority. The achievements of the past 2 terms of Conservative government show that this trust was well placed. And trust in the people will continue to be the foundation for the achievements of our third term.
Yeah.